This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. For most of us, hospitals are foreign territory. If your doctor recommends surgery, your first instinct might be to go to the hospital that he or she is affiliated with or the one nearest your home. But unless you're going by ambulance, you'd probably be better off doing a little research. There's now a range of information on hospital quality available to consumers, from federal agencies to private organizations. So what factors should you consider when choosing a hospital? We'll hear from Teo Francis of the Wall Street Journal, also from surgeon and author Dr. Mehmet Oz. Later in the program, how do you keep the plumbing at Hogwarts consistent from book to book? We'll talk with the Potterologist in chief. But first, choosing the right hospital. If you have questions about what information is available and what it means, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. We begin with Teo Francis, reporter for The Wall Street Journal, who joins us from the studios of member station WFSU in Tallahassee, Florida. Thanks for taking the time to be with us today.
Good to be here.
And one way or another, a lot of this new information is being provided by the federal government, or it's mined from government data. Why is it being made public now?
Well, there's a big push for better hospital quality for a couple of different reasons. One of them is quality for its own sake, obviously treating patients better, getting patients better treatment. The other part, though, is actually an effort to keep costs down or to keep the growth of costs down. Mm-hmm. There's a fair amount of evidence that in the long run, good medicine begets good health. And of course, good health means you spend less on health care.
Now, in the past, hospitals and doctors, for that matter, have resisted efforts to publicize data on the quality of health care, no?
Well, I mean, bad publicity or a poor showing in some kind of a comparison can be embarrassing. But on the other hand, as several experts have pointed out, that embarrassment can spur improvements like nothing else.
Mm-hmm. It can spur improvements because the hospital down the street is going to say, the studies show that we're better at cardiac care than general down the street.
Competition is part of it, but also just for its own sake, I think a lot of hospital administrators and doctors and nurses like to believe they're good at what they do, and most of them are. And if somebody's watching them, and they know somebody's watching them, they may try just a little harder still.
Now, you wrote in your article that a lot of hospitals now compete for patients across the country, not just even in their own communities. How are they doing that?
Well, you see it in a number of different ways. You see some hospital systems are expanding quite literally and building new hospitals in nearby areas or expanding the reach of their existing hospitals in one way or another. You also see some of the big-name hospitals are opening satellite campuses or facilities, mm-hmm. sometimes far from their home base.
Places like, for example, the Mayo Clinic or the Cleveland Clinic or some of the big New York hospitals?
That's right. Mm-hmm. You can find Mayo Clinic, I believe, in Jacksonville, Florida, and Sloan Kettering has some facilities in New Jersey, too, if I'm not mistaken.
Now, how do you find this information out, presumably on the web?
There's a lot of information on the web. It's in a lot of different places, and it's not all the same kind of information. So you have to be a little bit careful when you're taking a look at it, that you know what you're looking at and that you know what the measurements actually tell you.
Mm-hmm. And that's, as you suggest, not so easy at first glance.
It isn't, no. There's two broad kinds of measurements that you can find. There's what I call process measurements, what others call process measurements, which look at what hospitals do and how consistently they do it. Mm-hmm. A simple example is how often do they give aspirin to heart attack patients on arrival? It should be all the time or pretty much all the time. Another example is how often do surgery patients get antibiotics an hour before the first incision?
And this is broadly known as best practices, as far as I understand, and the theory being that if a hospital practices the best practices, presumably their quality of care overall is going to be better.
That's right. And there's scientific evidence. There have been research studies that show that these different procedures actually do lead to better care. The problem is it doesn't actually measure outcomes directly.
Mm-hmm.
So you have another school of thought which says, why look at the processes? You can only measure so many of them, and frankly, there's hundreds or thousands of things that have to happen for surgery to go well. So you might be giving a heart attack patient aspirin or beta blockers when you're supposed to be, but if your nursing care is subpar or you have a lot of temporary nurses who don't know their way around, you may have other problems that don't get caught in those measurements. So there's another school of thought that says look at the outcomes. Look at how well patients actually do. A very simple or straightforward way of doing that is to look at how many patients or what proportion of heart attack patients, for example, survive for 30 days after hospitalization.
And that
you can't get much more basic than that.
And that particular piece of data was just released a little while ago. But again, people are saying, critics are saying, it was released in such a way that it's not very helpful.
Well, it was released by the Medicare agency in a way that's not terribly helpful. The data from CMS, for example, for heart attack, that's the Medicare agency, for heart attack care showed 17 hospitals better than normal, better than expected. Seven were worse than expected. This is nationwide.
Yeah, so that's a lot of hospitals in the middle.
4,453 were no different than expected.
So it can warn you away from, a handful of hospitals and suggest a dozen or so that you might particularly seek out if it's convenient. But again, this is not going to help most people most of the time.
That's right. But underlying that Medicare data is more detailed data that different groups have harnessed. And it is possible to take a look at on some different websites and with different tools to take a look at mortality results a little more closely. So you can actually compare different hospitals one against the other beyond just better average or worse.
Mm. Tao Francis mentions a bunch of these websites in his article for the Wall Street Journal, and we've put links to them at our webpage. That's at npr.org/talk in case you'd like to check a couple of them out. Let's see if we can get some callers on the line. We're talking about how to choose a hospital. Our number, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And we'll begin with Graham. Graham's with us from Norman, Oklahoma.
Hi.
Hi.
Taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question. I hear a lot of hearsay about mishaps that happen at hospitals around here. But aside from, combing the news every day, is there any way you can get online? Is there some kind of database where you can actually see the ratios of medical mishaps at any given hospital?
Not that I know of. Medical errors are obviously a huge issue. But in terms of reporting, I believe they do get reported to regulators. But I don't think there's a good way you can go look up how often there's a medical error at one hospital as opposed to another.
And that would be useful information, though, wouldn't it?
It would be. On the other hand, it may be a little difficult to come by. It's hard to define an error, frankly. There are some things that are obvious errors. There's the the classic wrong leg amputation, for mm-hmm. example, and that's considered one of those never errors that hospitals and doctors should never make. But there are other areas that may be more of a bit gray mm-hmm. and harder to determine.
It's also mistakes like these can, as you suggest, it's hard to figure out sometimes what are mistakes, and it may be a long time before someone acknowledges that they're in a mistake because they may be in litigation.
That's right.
Yeah. So it maybe the information may eventually come out, or could even be sealed in some kind of a settlement. So hard to figure out sometimes.
That's right.
Yeah, Graham, thanks for the call. Good question.
Thank you.
Here's an email. This from Rachel in Washington, D.C. As someone who spent many years schooling and working at one of the top 10 hospitals, I won't name it, but believe me, it's one of the tops. I can honestly say, holy moly, if this is the best, I can only imagine what average hospitals are like. If I had an incurable disease or a disease that had the top researchers in the field at this institution, then I would be there with bells on. If I had a more mundane problem, I would go to a private hospital whose main focus is on patient care and not on research. And she addresses an interesting point. Hospitals overall might be good, but this one might be better for orthopedic and that one might be better for cardiac.
That's right. That's actually one of the most important things I picked up in reporting this piece, and that is that good hospitals are not equally good at everything. So you might hear from a nurse in the GI ward that you know that boy, this hospital is really great. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, that doesn't necessarily say a lot about its cardiac ward. So there's now, all things being equal, good hospitals are probably better at other things. But again, if you've got a specific condition, especially if it's a complex one or you have multiple conditions, You need to look beyond just the reputation of the hospital as a whole, or beyond a simple ranking of whether it's the best in the state or the fifth best in the state or something like that.
And it also might be interesting to know that it's how often it performs a certain procedure.
Right. Volume matters. The more often, studies suggest that the more often that a doctor performs a particular procedure, the more often that a hospital sees a particular procedure performed within its walls, really does matter. And so if you've got an unusual procedure coming up and your local hospital does two or three a year, they may be a very good hospital, but seriously consider going to another institution that does it more often.
Well, let's get John on the line. And John's with us from Grand Rapids in Michigan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Maybe you've covered this a little bit already, but between U.S. Reports and Consumer Reports and maybe a third-party rating organization like J.D. Power & Associates, what is the best way to get, I guess, consumer direct feedback on the healthcare system or hospitals in general? And I can take my answer off the air.
Okay, John, thanks.
I would argue the answer is all of the above. Just as consumers shouldn't go to just one place to get information about which hospital they should go to. Similarly, I think there's a lot of different ways of looking at hospital quality. You can look at patient satisfaction. There's a number of surveys that look at patient satisfaction with things like rooms and hospital meals. These things matter to some extent. And then you can also look at outcomes. You can also look at processes. I mean, there's a lot of different ways of looking at it, and consumers really should use more than one tool.
Tao Francis, thanks very much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Tao Francis, a reporter with The Wall Street Journal, who joined us from the studios of our member station WFSU in Florida. There's a link to his story and various sites to find out more about hospitals at our website. That's at npr.org/talk. We're discussing hospitals and how to choose the right one. Up next, Dr. Mehmet Oz gives us an inside perspective on finding the best medical care. We'll take more of your calls as well. 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing how to choose a hospital when it comes to picking the best one. There's plenty of information out there, rankings, online reviews, medical websites, even commercials on TV and radio. It's a lot of information. So how do you get through the clutter to find the best hospital for your condition? Obviously, if it's an emergency, you might be headed to the nearest ER. But today we're talking about what factors to consider when you have a choice. If you have questions, email us, talk@npr.org, or give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also let us know what you think on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And joining us now is Dr. Mehmet Oz. He's a surgeon and co-author of the popular You books, including You, the Smart Patient, and You on a Diet. He's in the studios of our member station in Las Vegas, KNPR. And Dr. Oz, nice to have you on the program again.
Great to be here, Neil.
And what's the most important thing patients should consider when they choose a hospital?
Well, the first thing, and just to bring up a comment you made earlier, obviously if it's an emergency, quote-unquote, which is the classic cop-out line that many patients give, but mm-hmm. The time to find the hospital is not when you're glaring up at the paramedic's eyes from your gurney. You want to do a little bit of homework ahead of time. And often, although the data is not clearly cut so that you can actually identify who's first, second, third, and fourth, you can figure out which hospital makes the most sense for you. There are lists of hospitals that are accredited in this country by an organization called the Joint Commission. That's actually the group that asked us to write the Smart Patient. And the reason they did that was because they acknowledged that there were between 50 and 100,000 people a year who lose their lives in hospitals. And regardless of what the specific error was, we believe those lives are savable. The big concern that we all have, speaking about these broad policy issues, is that we are not using our biggest ally. The biggest ally for us working within the hospital field is you, the smart patient. So the question then becomes, what are the things you should know about, the questions you should ask? Forget about all the lists. They're there. And by the way, private insurance companies are also coming up with lists mm-hmm. because the most expensive medicine is bad medicine. And they have their own appropriate self-interest reasons of creating these for us. But if we're not ready to use this information and change the care we're getting accordingly, then it won't make a difference. And let me just give you a very concrete example. If you check into a hospital, the three things you ought to remember are infections, injections, and neglections. So infect means keeping an alcohol gel or something by your bedside. Anybody who comes in to visit you, as unobtrusively as you can, ask them if they don't mind putting some of that gel in your hands. Now, there are all kinds of signs all over hospitals, including mine, New York Presbyterian, which, by the way, does very, very well in all these rating systems. But I can tell you, it's sometimes difficult to get folks to comply, but a smart patient has the alcohol there. It's very difficult to get past that gauntlet if they're saying, please put some alcohol gel in your hands. Simple things like asking them to clean the stethoscope. It makes a difference.
And don't be afraid of being a little rude.
Well, you know, it's so interesting you bring that up, Neil, because it's so important. Everyone feels that they're going to destroy that precious covenant with their doctor if they put their hands up. And you know what? You're right. If you put your hands up, sometimes you get shot. But this is part of a movement. Think of it this way. It is your most patriotic duty to put your hand up and be a stick in the mud, because what you're really saying is make the system better, not only to benefit me, but everybody else who's going to come after me is going to benefit from the fact that you got up and said, you know what, we don't do the most we can for infections. You're not, for example, wearing a bow tie, you're wearing a regular tie. I know that sounds like a crazy example, but Neil, let me ask you, have you ever washed a tie?
No.
Right. No one has. So if I'm walking around in a hospital with a regular tie on, and my tie, when I lean over my patient, as caring as I am, if it scrapes over your wound, I'm picking up bacteria. There's actually a study done in England where they compare doctors who wear bow ties or scrubs to doctors who wear conventional ties, and they're actually big infection differences because the conventional ties pick up bacteria. Simple insight. It's not rocket science for you to be an advocate for yourself and everybody else after you to make this movement happen.
You want your doctor to look like Tucker Carlson?
Well, you can tuck your tie into your shirt, which makes you look like a nerd, but it works. You can wear scrubs. There are lots of things you can do.
Here's an email we have from Stephanie in Portland, Oregon. There are user-generated websites such as rateyourprofessor.com. Why not have a rateyourdoctor.com? Shouldn't there be more transparency and a place for patients and customers to voice individual comments?
Absolutely, and I love the idea, and I would advocate using your blog right now as a potential source for that. There are many opportunities for us to exchange information. The problem, of course, is it's very difficult to differentiate a patient who feels erroneously that they've gotten wrong care from someone who truly has gotten wrong care, which is why, at the end of the day, it's simple things done by people on the front lines that make the biggest difference. And mistakes like operating on the wrong side, which happens 75 times a year, Neil. Now, think about that. There was a case recently where someone had the wrong kidney taken out. That condemned them to dialysis. How do you prevent that? Well, when you go to the operating room at the hospital, I don't care how good the hospital is. If you're supposed to have surgery in your left arm, on your left arm, operate here. But go one step further, because if they're so incompetent, they're going to operate in the wrong arm, they'll drape the good arm out of the field. So on the other arm, right, don't operate here.
Not here, yeah. Don't cut here. So have a Sharpie with you when you go in.
Well, you know, it sounds embarrassing to admit it, but why not? Why not help me? I've got so many things going on in my life as a busy professional practicing medicine that as much as I care about you, mistakes might happen. Why not help make sure you're not a rat in someone else's experiment? And I'll give you one big tidbit that I personally advocate for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Never leave your relative alone in the hospital. If you really want to show someone you love them, especially at night, leave a sentry there. One of the kids, that's what caregiving is all about. That's when you need relatives. You don't need them waiting in the waiting room praying for you. You need them in the hospital helping take care of you, because in the middle of the night, when you need something done, you can't call 911. You're already in a hospital.
Yeah, and it's not just if the patient's the godfather. You've got other problems. Anyway,
exactly.
Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Mark. Mark's with us from Silver Lake in Ohio.
Terrific show, as usual.
Thank you.
I'm delighted, but I'm not surprised. But I did want to make a comment very briefly. Given the choice of going to a hospital where I know I'm going to get all-star surgical care and average nursing care versus a hospital where I'll get at least very competent surgical care, but top-notch nursing care, I'll take the top-notch nurses any day of the week. These people are so important in terms of a hospital experience and hospital care that I think they're at least as critical as what the doctors do.
Dr. Oz, what do you think?
Mark, I advocate everything you're saying, and I cry out on this topic, and in The Smart Patient, we emphasize this as well. One of the ways that you rate hospitals, by the way, in some of these surveys, including the U.S. News and World Report, what is just coming out this week, I believe, is the number of nurses they have per patients. But I tell my nurses this at New York Presbyterian all the time. They are the absolute foundation. They are the caregivers, and I agree with you. I'd much rather have great nursing care and pretty darn good surgical care, because the big mistakes that hurt us a lot often happen because of mistakes in how our nurses provide care. And one of the biggest shortages we have in this country today is that we don't have enough folks going into nursing. And if you're listening to this program and you've got someone who you think might be good at nursing, send them our way. We are desperate to get good nurses.
I really appreciate hearing a physician saying this.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Mark. We mentioned emergency rooms earlier. You say they all have an ER level. What does that mean, and why is it important?
ERs are rated according to the complexity of the cases they can take care of. The most obvious is a trauma center, which can take care of all kinds of crazy things that may happen in a car accident or even in penetrating trauma. But let's go one step past that. The fact of the matter is there is an ER of your dreams. There is the ER that's perfect for the problem you have. So, for example, if you're having a heart attack or a stroke, you want to know, and this data is available for hospitals, you want to know how long it takes from the time you suffer your symptoms until you get treated aggressively for either the heart attack or the stroke. That is life-saving. And that data is available, and some ERs are really good at it and other ones stink. On the other hand, if you've got a little cut in your hand, you may not want to go to the level one trauma center because you may want to get the more convenient care that's available near your home. So take the time today. Go visit an emergency room, but do it in the middle of the day. Here's the real key, Neil. You don't want to go there at 4 in the morning, obviously. It's not convenient for anybody. But in the middle of the afternoon, emergency rooms are generally quiet because the doctor's offices haven't closed yet, and they've cleaned up the mess from the night before. So middle of the afternoon, pop by. See what kind of a place it is. What kind of lines are there? Is the place clean? And these are the kinds of small bits of homework that make a huge difference for the entire system. Because you know what? If a hospital sees that people don't want to go to their emergency room, guess what they do? They fix their ER.
Let's get Charles on the line. Charles with us from Phoenix, Arizona.
Yes, good afternoon.
Hi.
I was calling. I lost my father 4 years ago, went to a community hospital for bypass surgery, not emergency. And even with a cardiologist who's a cousin at Johns Hopkins and a professor, didn't obviously know the right questions to ask and died from an adverse medicine interaction that the hospital didn't even test for, which obviously they now have instituted that. But it seemed to anybody that we've spoke to that it was fairly should have been a fairly common test that we didn't know at the time to ask for that caused his death. And then the time of year, the day of the week, being it was the Sunday night of Father's Day that he started having that adverse reaction, and the nurse gave him Tylenol rather than doing any kind of tests. And I was wondering, like, how do, for specific, like you had said, you know, ask the questions, but even some of the questions are even too specific, sometimes don't even know, and I'll take that off the air, I guess.
Okay, Charles, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And well, sorry for your loss.
I'm sorry as well, Charles. And the country is touched all over by individuals who have lost loved ones. In fact, we estimate that 40% of Americans, 2 out of every 5 people listening to this broadcast, will have their lives changed adversely by a medical error. If you include people who are dear to you, it probably is everybody. The question is, what do you do about it? We wrote the Smart Patient for the Joint Commission. That's the group that accredits hospitals, and they're sort of the patient safety champion for the country. And they put a lot of effort into trying to figure out what questions to ask. And there are, by the way, routine questions that are worth asking that we on the inside know to be true. And I think that if folks get more comfortable pushing some of those buttons, day of the week surgery is a good example. A lot of folks know that you don't want to buy a car on a particular day of the week. There are equal rules, by the way, on surgery. I would not have surgery on a Friday afternoon because that's when all the emergencies come pouring in if you need heart surgery, which is what I do. But the reality, Neil, is that most Americans spend more time figuring out what kind of kitchen appliance to buy than the type of hospital they're going to go to. And the little bit of extra homework that we can do on that makes a huge difference within the hospital system. As was discussed earlier on the same program, hospitals change behavior based on the biases of their patients. You know, a lot of folks say, well, you know, that's cheating. They're sending out the harder cases. Mm-hmm. Well, God bless them. That's what they should do. If you're not good at a particular difficult case, you should shift it out. And if someone's keeping track and someone's asking tough questions, then you're going to do better off by shipping those patients out. We saw this experience in the first major database in the country, which is the New York State Database on Cardiac Surgery Mortality. And I'm at New York Presbyterian Hospital. We had pretty good numbers. And we saw a lot of very difficult cases coming our way. And you know what? It was okay because we had the capability as a major transplant center to cope. Smaller hospitals also got better. Why? Because they recognized where their forte was, where their strength was, and they avoided those cases. That's better for everybody. The whole system gets better. And what pushed it? It was people reading the paper, paying attention to the surveys. We estimate only 11% of you pay attention to the data that's already out there that rates hospitals. Why not take that number up? Why not be an important driver, a catalyst for change? Only 10% of you have got to be involved. That will be the tipping point for health safety in this country. But 10% of us have got to wake up and start auditing the system.
We're talking with Dr. Mehmet Oz, surgeon, author of the You books, including You, the Smart Patient. And we're talking about questions you should ask about choosing the right hospital for you and your procedure. If you'd like to join us, our number, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation, which is coming to you from NPR News. And let's see if we can get, this is Susan. Susan's with us from Odessa, Georgia.
Correct.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Thank you. I'm sorry I missed the little part while I was talking to the screener, because I think Dr. Oz spoke to the issue that I think is most critical when you are selecting a hospital, and that is the if you can know the rate of nosocomial infection or infection acquired in the hospital. MRSA is really getting out of hand, and people are suffering long life consequences, sometimes, unfortunately, even having their life cut short because of it. And hand washing is really the answer in large measure. As to his statement about washing your hands between patients, when I go in to see a patient, I wash my hands in front of them, even if I've just washed my hands in the hallway, so that they know that I've washed my hands. And because I've been in this kind of work for so long, I want to be sure that my hands are clean, because I don't want to take anything out of that room to the next patient or to my family. I think this is a great show that you're doing, and I will take your comments off the phone. Thank you so much.
Clearly, Susan does not suffer from eczema, but go ahead.
No, Susan knows what she's talking about, too. And, Susan, I think the message you're sending to the patients is so important. You don't want them to feel like they're dirty. You want to feel like they're clean, and that you're doing an extra step to make sure they stay clean. But as a patient, I know it's awkward. I mean, it's really difficult. But if you make it simple and automate it, even put a fun sign up, you know, joke around about it, everybody gets comfortable and they begin to expect it. And part of the problem with errors overall is that we don't ask those difficult questions. Take the second opinion concept, which is now I think beginning to become a wave or a movement in the country. 10% of us are comfortable getting second opinions, which means, by the way, checking out other hospitals as well.
Mm-hmm.
One third of the time, Neil, 33% of the time, a second opinion will change your diagnosis or your treatment. I mean, how can you not get a second opinion? This holds true, by the way, with asking some of the difficult questions, like what's your infection rate? And by the way, if the person you're talking to or the hospital that you're working through doesn't know their infection rate, doesn't know their mortality rate for the procedure you're going to have, then you shouldn't have the procedure there. Because people who aren't keeping track probably aren't doing as good a job as people who are.
Let's get Jeff on the line. Jeff with us from Truckee in California.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question was regarding insurance. I went through in the last 12 months, had two different major surgeries, one on my abdomen and one on my hip. I couldn't actually get my insurance to cover my local hospital, well, actually my local surgeon. They cover the hospital. But in terms of my interview, the surgeon I interviewed was fantastic, and that was who I wanted to go with. But then I had to go through a petition process through my insurance company. Are there ways to alleviate that? Is there things that are going to change in the future with more insurance companies covering, you know, your choice of surgeons? And then to follow up on that is, I think another good question that you haven't alluded to just yet is, also, what's your recovery time, and is there physical therapy, and what's physical therapy like?
Well, there's a whole litany of questions you ought to ask before you have surgery, including is it done minimally invasively, what kind of anesthesia is used. Obviously, physical therapy afterwards is very important. How much pain will you have? How long are you going to be laid up for? Those are all, by the way, outlined in the Smart Patient book. But the bigger question you ask, which I think is an important one, is what are we going to do with insurance in this country? I think we've got about 10,000 insurers in this country for 5,000 hospitals. So we've got a lot of folks making up their own rules. I'll give you a little secret, Jeff. When you have a problem with your insurance company, reach out to the medical director of the company, because that person's a doctor and they don't want to have to deal with headaches like logistical issues between one hospital versus the other. If there's a meaningful, important reason why you can't get the care at that hospital that you want to get, for example, they have terrible results in it and the insurer knows it, then let them share that with you. Otherwise, push that button. Do it by paper so they can't get out of it, and fax it to the medical director.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Jeff, good luck.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We're talking with Dr. Mehmet Oz, and we'll continue taking your calls about how to choose the best hospital in just a couple of minutes. Plus, also, Harry Potter's fact checker. Can you name all the Weasley kids? I'll give you a hint. There are seven of them. Sleepy Snee. No, that's another thing. The publisher's Potterologist in chief has to keep them all straight. And remember, Ginny's boyfriends, too. We'll talk with the continuity editor for Harry Potter. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we're continuing our conversation about how to choose the best hospital. Our guest is Dr. Mehmet Oz, a surgeon and author of the You books, including You, the Smart Patient, and You on a Diet. He's with us today from KNPR, our member station in Las Vegas. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And Dr. Oz, there's some hospitals have something called a hospital list. Who is that, and should I want that person to be there?
You absolutely want that person involved in your care. A hospitalist is somebody who lives in the hospital, who knows how the hospital functions, knows the ins and outs of how to take care of folks who are in the hospital, and can help your primary doctor manage you while you get there. Here's the old-fashioned model. You go see your general practitioner. He diagnoses you with some problem that's, let's say, hormonal. You get admitted to the hospital, and then all of a sudden, you have to get squeezed in around their schedule. So while they're back in their office seeing the 25 patients they're going to see that day, they'll either pop in early on and see you or late in the evening and see you, and they're not focused on you the whole day long. The intensivist or the hospitalist only takes care of folks who are in the hospital. Their primary motivation is to make sure you get the best in-hospital care possible and then transition your care in an orderly fashion back to your family doctor. And that is very important.
All right, let's get another caller on the line. Linda's with us. Linda from West Bloomfield in Michigan.
Hey there.
Hey.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. Both of my children were recently had outpatient surgery at a local hospital. And it was in a pediatric wing that they just finished building. So their care was absolutely wonderful. The nurses were unbelievable. But my question is that their doctors were also unbelievable. What happens if you really, really like that doctor, really want that doctor, because they've got a good record, they handle their patients wonderfully, but maybe the hospital they're at isn't on the wonderful list, and they don't operate anyplace else? Then what happens? And I can take your answer off the air.
Okay, Linda, thanks very much.
Well, I'm going to be a little harsh here, Neil, but I want to speak honestly to Linda's concern. One of the ways that we judge how good a doctor is at what hospital is what hospitals they practice at. If you're not taking the time to investigate the hospital that you're practicing at and not taking the extra effort, putting in the extra quarter to go first class to make sure your nursing is as good as you are, then I don't think you're doing the best you can. And one of the biggest problems we have in healthcare in America is that too often physicians think their primary responsibility is to do what they're trained to do, which is to make sure we deliver the best care that we can. But we have an additional obligation. As a professional class, we have a civic responsibility to speak up when the system itself isn't working. And making sure that nursing care is as good as the care we provide is one of those obligations. So, Linda, if your doctor's great, but they haven't taken the time to be at a good hospital, sign up to be part of great nursing, or fix the nursing where they are, that you should rethink choosing them to do the surgery.
Here's an email from Kim. I'm a nurse in Hood River, Oregon. My suggestion is to talk to the nurses. Also bring a patient advocate with you when you have any procedure, a family member, friend, or in the case of labor or delivery, hire a doula support person to attend your birth. If a hospital has the magnet status, that's a good sign of happy nurses, which results in good patient care. That's an award given by the American Nurses Credentialing Center, an affiliate of the American Nurses Association, to hospitals that satisfy a set of criteria designed to measure the strength and quality of their nursing. Would you endorse that?
Fully endorse it. The magnet hospital status can be found, by the way, at nursingworld.org. It's a very difficult credential to get. Hospitals have to work very hard to prove their nursing is of that caliber, and it's one of the great ways of figuring out if you've got wonderful nurses. But I want to go back to the biggest point is that they came into the hospital with loved ones, and they stayed with them. Having a witness, a caregiver, somebody who's going to be there when you're in your time of need is incredibly important. The doula movement, for example, with women having children has become a very powerful one. And the reason I emphasize this is that when everyone's moving around at 100 miles an hour, having somebody there does two things. It helps, you know, pick up any loose ends. But think of the conversation you have with the people taking care of you. You know, we know as physicians that 50% of what we tell you is forgotten or not understood. 50%. Neil, that's pretty frustrating. What if half of the show was not listened to by the folks out there? Well, then, you know, you wouldn't do such a good job, perhaps. You'd cut it short. So if you've got somebody with you, the physician takes a little extra time to fully explain it because they think you're going to do your homework right. Remember, the word doctor means teacher. So you coming to class with notepad, a tape recorder, a friend who's going to help you take notes, all of these send the right signals to the doctor that you're a smart patient and we've got to be serious with you.
Let's say we have time for one last call. Julie. Julie's with us from Cape Cod. Julie, are you there? Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Great. I have a question for the doctor. I am right now being considered as a candidate for a procedure that was just recently approved by the FDA in the United States. It's called a Birmingham hip resurfacing. And they're considering me because I'm young and have a deteriorated hip as a result of a birth defect. And I'm having a lot of difficulty finding a doctor in the United States, and I'm actually considering going overseas to have the procedure done in Birmingham, England. And I'm wondering if there might be any websites regarding hospitals and the doctor's qualifications to perform this procedure overseas.
And I'd like you to answer Julie's question, Dr. Oz, but also broadly, more broadly, when is it worth it to go across state, across the country, or in her case, overseas?
So let's tackle the overseas issue first. There are some groups, the Joint Commission, by the way, is one of them that actually credentials hospitals internationally. So in many countries of the world, you can at least find out if the hospital where this procedure is being done is an accredited one by a U.S. organization. That's a pretty good step in the right direction. Generally speaking, if the procedure is being limited in this country because technology is not here, that's defensible, I think, for wanting to leave the country. But overall, I'd much rather folks think of it this way. You never want to be the first person. Because the first person is where we learn and figure out what we made right, maybe what we did wrong, and thus the improved version is what we actually use on folks as the procedures mature. The FDA is a conservative organization, and I may be naive and criticized by some of you for believing this, but I think they do a pretty good job making sure they do their homework, and they generally approve technologies that deserve to be approved in a timely fashion. Across the board in this country, what I always tell folks is if your ailment is a less common one, for example, a young person needing a hip replacement, go to the literature and find peer-reviewed papers published for doctors by doctors, and look at the names and the institutions where they're published from. Those are the hospitals where you want to go have that procedure done if it's a new one, because those are the hospitals that have already accumulated 50 or 100 cases. Remember, most of the common procedures that we do in this country, and I'm a heart surgeon, I do several hundred open heart operations a year. If I was going to give you an operation that I do three times a year, I probably won't do it quite as well. That should be the general rule of thumb for most folks listening on. Look at the numbers of cases that are generally done. If the institution that you're considering doesn't do a proportional number of those, perhaps the most or one of the most in the region, you probably should look elsewhere across state lines.
All right.
Julie, good luck.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
And Dr. Oz, thanks so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Neil, you have a great program, and I love your callers. Love them. Thanks for having me on.
Mehmet Oz, a surgeon and co-author of the You books, including You, the Smart Patient. He joined us today from member station KNPR in Las Vegas. Coming up, the Potterologist.